nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
My name is Tim Sands. I'm a professor in materials science and engineering, or it's called materials engineering here, and electrical and computer engineering, and also I'm a member of the Burke Nanotechnology Center. My background, basically, I'm trained in materials science, but I've strayed quite a bit over the years, like many of the people you've heard speak, I think, lately. You're trained in a traditional discipline, typically, and then your interests take you other directions. Eventually, you're not categorizable, which is where I stand now, which is why I have joint appointments and what have you. So I'm going to go through. This is intended to be a very informal presentation, hopefully just interactive. I've got about 35 minutes worth of material that if I were in a room by myself, just speaking to myself in front of a mirror, it would take me about 35 minutes. So feel free to interrupt. We've got, I think, plenty of time. And also, please let me know if I'm talking about something that is you've already heard, you don't want to hear it again, or especially if I say something that you don't understand at all, or I'm using language or jargon that doesn't connect. Please stop me at any moment. I want to start off just with this picture here, which I don't know if you can see too clearly. I think it's probably okay. These are two nanowires composed of segments of silicon and silicon germanium alternating. You can kind of see the contrast here. This is a transmission electron microscope image. You may have seen these before. It's basically like a light microscope, but we use electrons instead of photons because they have smaller wavelength and we can resolve things on the atomic scale. This is not an atomic scale image. The dimension here is about 100 nanometers, scale bar down here. And by now I understand you have a pretty good idea what 100 nanometers means. If you didn't before, you know now. It's roughly about 1,000th the diameter of a human hair, these nanowires. So what are they good for, and what are nanomaterials good for in general? Hopefully I can begin to answer any questions you might have. I mean, in the absence of knowing exactly what you want to talk about, I pose these questions as a framework for this presentation, but I'll do anything else you want if I can. I'll first say something about what a quantum dot is. I don't know, have you heard that expression, a quantum dot? Probably many times. You probably have a sense of what it is, but I'll go back over that. What is a nanowire? What do we mean by a nanowire? What is a nanotube? And why are they scientifically interesting? What is it that a material scientist like myself, for example, gets excited about when we start seeing or working with quantum dots, nanowires, and nanotubes? Also, what are their potential applications? Because in my field, anyway, we're a hybrid between science and engineering, so we're always thinking about the application. That's ultimately driving us. The scientific questions excite us, but we don't look at everything that's scientifically interesting. We pick things that we think will ultimately lead to understanding that will lead to applications. So I will say something about their potential applications. We can talk endlessly on this if something interests you. I probably only touch on about a third of the basic categories of applications. And then I'd like to spend a little bit of time on how they're made. How do we make these quantum-confined and nanoscale structures in the laboratory? And if you want, we can talk a little bit about the issues of scaling them up. What if we wanted to manufacture them? What if we wanted to scale up for, you know, structural materials, electronic materials, optical materials? What are the issues? I didn't plan any slides on that, but I'd be happy to go into that if you have any questions. And actually, let me ask right now, are there any other sort of major questions that you have about nanomaterials at this very moment? Obviously, you can interrupt any time, but is there anything else on this list I should cover? Okay, well, we'll get to it. So if something pops in your head, please just interrupt me. So let me start off with, what is a quantum dot? A quantum dot is any solid material in the form of a particle with a diameter comparable to the wavelength of an electron. So I'm not sure, you know, this is often a tough concept to get over in the university level students that I deal with. Even graduate students still struggle with wave-particle duality. I don't know where you are in that, but I will spend a little time on that, so hopefully at least in the context of the way I look at it. You know what I mean when I'm talking about the wavelength of an electron. This is a picture, actually, of a cadmium selenide quantum dot. It's about 5 nanometers in diameter. Each of these white spots corresponds to a column of atoms. So this is taken with a transmission electron microscope. The crystal, it's a single crystal, and it was tilted in the microscope to line up so that the atomic columns are right behind each other. The atoms in the column are right behind each other. Yeah, it would be like imagining. Yeah, we're looking. That's right. We're looking down. Either you can think of the white dots as the row of atoms or the channel between rows of atoms. Actually, it turns out that in this image there's an ambiguity. You have to be very careful to distinguish between those two cases. You can actually get it to switch contrast by just changing the focus a little bit. But in essence, that's what
so
you
this
have.
Picture.
That's probably correct. Yeah, I can't tell you that for sure. In fact, I need what's called a through focal series. This is getting into a lot of detail. We basically just keep changing the focus, and we would see the contrast change where, and then we could fit it, match that to a model of the image, and figure out where the atoms actually sit. But you can see what the atomic spacing is. And this is a picture actually of the same quantum dots, but they are arranged themselves in a lattice. So look at the scale here; is much larger. We're backed up quite a bit. They self-organize themselves into arrays, and this is a two-dimensional array of these quantum dots, separated by organic spacers, molecules. So I just show this to give an example of a quantum dot. There are many, many others, but they basically all look like this. What is a nanowire? When I use the term nanowire, I'm talking about any solid material in a form of a wire with a diameter smaller than about 100 nanometers. That's a somewhat arbitrary demarcation. Actually, it was set by the National Nanotechnology Initiative in the U.S. That decided that 100 nanometers was nanotechnology. But it actually does have some physical significance because a lot of the characteristic lengths in matter are of this scale or smaller. So the wavelength of an electron, how far an electron can travel before it scatters off another electron or off a lattice vibration, the wavelength of lattice vibrations, how far a lattice vibration can travel before it scatters. All those, and the wavelength of light, of visible light, is a few hundred nanometers and above. So this is in that ballpark as well. So it's not an arbitrary number, but generally if it's larger than 100 nanometers in diameter, we wouldn't call it a nanowire. This particular micrograph is also an transmission electron micrograph. It's a nanowire formed by the vapor-liquid-solid method, which I'll talk about briefly at the end. But basically, we have segments of indium phosphide, which is a semiconducting material, and indium arsenide alternating in this nanowire. On the top, we have a small gold particle, which is a catalyst particle that allowed us to grow it. I'll talk about that a little later.
The properties of the wire, but you have variable thickness in the red one.
Mm-hmm.
I can't pronounce the first name, but the arsenide.
Indium arsenide.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's right. We'll talk about that in some detail, but the dimension here is only on the order of a few nanometers. And here it's maybe a little lighter. Here we're talking about maybe 30 or 40 nanometers.
And that's not on purpose. That's just what happened.
No, this is very much on purpose.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it happens, as we'll talk about, this will connect to some of the things we'll talk about later, but the electrons in this material, the ones that are free to roam, will be somewhat trapped by these indium arsenide segments. And they'll be quantum confined. They'll be squeezed. And their properties are different when they're quantum confined than when they're in the bulk of the material, when they're in a bulk material. So I'll get into that in a little detail too. Sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
I've never seen the term micrograph.
Mm-hmm. Nothing special. It's like a photograph. We would say photograph if we're talking about optical camera, something you would use yourself to digital camera or something. That would be a photograph. Micrograph refers to a magnified image. So if you took a optical photograph, but with a magnifying lens, and your magnification was high enough, we might call that a micrograph, just to indicate that it's magnified. An electron micrograph is the same thing, but we're talking about magnifications that are in the range of millions rather than just hundreds. So wavelength of an electron here, just a little side, is about, I think it was 0.0037 nanometers, I think, for the microscopes used here. This is much, much less than a nanometer. The wavelength of a photon, a quanta of light, what we see around us, what stimulates our rods and cones, is on the order of half a micron. So it's much, much bigger. So it's on the order of 500 nanometers. So we can't see things much smaller than 500 nanometers with light. But with electrons, we can see atoms because the wavelength is actually smaller. The wavelength the electrons use to make this image is smaller than the atom, much smaller.
I'm not going to ask you what you mean by the wavelength of an electron.
It's coming. It is coming. What is a nanotube? Well, a nanotube is a hollow nanowire, so it's just exactly what you'd think. The wall thickness is typically on the order of molecular dimensions. So that's something, when we say a nanotube, we're assuming that we're talking about something with molecular dimension wall thickness. The smallest and I think the most interesting nanotube is a single wall carbon nanotube. It's usually abbreviated SWNT. And it consists of a single graphene sheet rolled up in a tube. And I was going to do this a little later, but let me go ahead and do it now since we're here. This is a graphene sheet. Okay, so each of these hexagons, or I should say the vertices, represent the position of carbon atoms. Okay. So if you imagine wherever two lines intersect, or three lines intersect, I'm sorry, at that point, there's a carbon atom. And if you take the graphite from your pencil lead, for example, and you looked at it in an electron microscope, you'd find out that it was composed of sheets, graphene sheets, two-dimensional sheets like this. And that's what gives rise to the lubricating properties, the fact that it slides off onto your paper and the fact that you can make a nice lubricant out of just graphite particles.
Just curious. Mm-hmm. When they're overlaid like that, would the carbon atoms line up linearly as well?
They will have in a crystal of graphite, they will be aligned. But in real graphite that you would see in, a pencil lead, it's somewhat randomized, and the sheets are not all perfect. They might be locally organized in a specific way, but really not on a large scale. They are so weakly bound between the sheets that they slide across each other, and that's why they're a good lubricant. They slide.
That bond between them is called a van der Waal.
It's a van der Waal. Yeah, it's a weak bond. It's a pi electron bond, but it's a very weak bond compared to the bonds in the plane. The bonds in the plane are very, very strong. This is the material that obviously makes up diamond. It's just that in diamond, for each carbon atom, you have four carbon atoms around it in tetrahedral coordination, and you form a three-dimensional lattice that way. So you can think of the bonds of the carbon atoms in the plane as being virtually as strong as they are in diamond, but the sheets between them just slide. Okay, now that's graphite. This is called graphene, though, a single sheet. Take the graphene, roll it up, and you have a carbon nanotube.
Does it matter whether you roll it lengthwise or?
Yes, it does. And in fact, I'll show a little bit of that later, but that's chirality. That's called chirality. You can roll it lengthwise, or one direction is called an armchair, and the other one is zigzag. But you can also cant it, and if you try to do it, it's kind of hard to do it, but don't roll it up along one of those axes. Line it up with a slight displacement. See how I've displaced these two? That is also a nanotube, and it has different properties than this nanotube. By just changing the attachment points, and you can change it from a metal to a semiconductor. And a metal, it conducts electricity easily. The semiconductor doesn't. But then changing the diameter of the nanotube, you change the electronic properties as well. So I don't know if Professor Lundstrom spoke to you about the future of silicon electronics. He probably talked a little bit about carbon nanotubes, I would think. You need a very specific diameter of carbon nanotube, actually about 1.3 nanometers. And it has to be single-walled, and it has to be of the proper chirality. That has to be lined up properly in order to be useful as a semiconducting material. So, and it's very specific. And that's the big headache in carbon nanotubes right now, is how do you control the chirality?
Yeah. Right now, basically, when you make them, you make a collection of everything, and you sort of
that's right.
Look for it if you want.
Yep. And it's getting better. I mean, just in the last few months, pretty much every few months, you notice that there are new techniques emerging for controlling the chirality. In some cases, they're accidental, and in some cases, there's some thought process that led to that approach. But I don't know whether we'll get there. I mean, it's a big question right now. Industrial applications of semiconducting tubes would require that we control the chirality. I guess I don't need to do this because I understand you've had a lot of this. So you can just add it to your collection of how big is a nanometer. And it's in there, so I'll leave. And also I have this slide, which you may have seen, which is kind of useful. It's from an NRC report that you can get on the web. So I won't belabor that because I think you've had enough of that. So what makes these nanostructured materials, quantum dots, nanowires, nanotubes, scientifically interesting? Well, there are a lot of reasons why one might be interested in them. The electronic and optical properties, which I'll focus on, are probably the biggest opportunity. They're really the most confining electrical conductors, nanowires and nanotubes. That if you have a nano, or if you have a quantum dot or a nanoparticle, it doesn't itself conduct electricity. You have to put contacts on it. But in a nanotube or nanowire, you can put contacts at either end, and you can pass current through it. You can pass heat through it. So it's probably the if you're going to make a device of some sort where you have current or heat or something flowing, it's the most confined structure you can have that will allow that. One very interesting factor is that they're small enough that they can be essentially free of defects. You can't do that in practice with a bulk crystal, but with a nanoscale material, you can make it defect-free. That means you see properties that only appear in the textbooks. You've never really seen them before in a real material because they're not ideal. They have defects. Now with these nanoscale materials, you make a perfect crystal. You see what the textbook says you should see, which is kind of interesting. For example, electrons can move ballistically. They can travel without scattering from one end of your nanotube to the other. And that's very difficult to do in a bulk material or a thin film. Normally, they scatter about as they make their way across the material. And so we see properties that are simple but intriguing and allow us to test some basic physics. Quantum confinement gives us tunable optical properties as well as electronic properties.
Mm-hmm. Can I go back to your use of the word confining? Mm-hmm. And by that, you mean it's sort of like a barrel. There's less ability to stray.
Yeah.
There's less leakage or whatever. So
yeah.
It's more efficient in its travel.
It's not only more efficient. That's true. It could be more efficient, but it's more. It's different. It's in a different environment than it normally is. An electron traveling in a bulk material doesn't really see the boundaries. But if you put an electron in a small nanostructured material, it starts to see the boundaries, its properties change. It thinks it really knows it's in a confined structure. Its energy changes, and all of its other properties, like optical properties, resulting from the electron will change. So we'll get into that in a little detail. Mechanical properties, again, small enough to be defect-free, so you start seeing things like ideal strengths. If you take a piece of copper and you measure its strength, its resistance to deformation, you find out that it's something like a factor of 20 below what you would have predicted. But that's because it's got defects in it, and the defects help it deform. If you take a carbon nanotube, it's going to show, probably, if it's a clean carbon nanotube, it's going to show ideal strength behavior. There aren't any extended defects that would weaken it. So this is allowing us to look at some basic ideas about the mechanical properties of materials. And also to imagine building some very strong composite materials that essentially have, for example, carbon nanotubes that have ideal strength, much stronger than steel, embedded within a polymer. You can imagine what that could do in terms of properties and making composites. So this is something that a lot of people at Purdue and other places are looking at. Thermal properties, you can make these things conduct heat substantially better, as in a carbon nanotube, or much worse, as in most nanowires, than nearly every bulk material. You can go to each extreme. You can make a material that's more thermally conductive than diamond, and you can make a material that is less thermally conductive than glass out of materials that normally conduct heat very well. So that, it turns out, is very important for applications. Both ends are important. If you want to make something that carries heat away, you've got an option. If you want to make something that traps heat, like if you're making an energy conversion device, then you've got that too. Chemical properties, and I understand you've looked a little bit into this, dominated by the large surface-to-volume ratio. absolutely dominant, the fact that that surface is so much. So many of the atoms are actually on the surface. In a single-wall carbon nanotube, they're all on the surface. In a nanowire, maybe 10%, 5%, or 80% are within an atomic spacing or two of the surface. I mean, not 100%, but they all feel the surface. And there's, having that much surface means that you can detect things much more sensitively than you would normally be able to do in a typical material. So, in short, these are new materials. Although they're made up of materials that are familiar, like a graphene sheet, when you turn it into a nanotube, it is a new material. It's a distinct new material. So, and as we talked about already, depending on how you wrap it up, its properties are different. So that's really why there is so much interest in the materials community in nanostructured materials, because they really are new. That is a really good question. I don't know the answer to the... I believe they are also found in the soot that you would see buckyballs in. Maybe, Nick, do you know that offhand? I believe that Sumio Ujima's work, who was the first one to take an electron microscope image of a nanotube, I believe he was able to produce them in soot. So as another flavor of carbon, just like the buckyball. I mean, it's in essence they're very similar to buckyballs. If you've looked into that, a buckyball, of course, is a spherical or spheroid-like object that closes in on itself. A carbon nanotube is the same idea, but now you're just wrapping it around. You're wrapping the sheet around to make the curved end of a carbon nanotube, or to make a buckyball, you have to rearrange the bond slightly in order to get it to fold up. In the carbon nanotube, you just basically bend the graphene sheet. So it's not that it has any defects in it normally. It could, but normally it wouldn't have to. You just essentially bend it around. So I think the answer is yes, the carbon nanotubes you would find in nature, I don't think they have any practical significance. I don't think they affect anything out there. They certainly aren't present in single as specific chirality carbon nanotubes. You couldn't mine them, I guess, and hope to have any kind of yield. So let me say something about electronic and optical properties. And this, I don't, maybe a completely redundant. Stop me or tell me to move faster or whatever if this gets a little too basic. This picture here, well, I'm thinking of the electron as a particle here, just for convenience. Of course, the electron is a wave. And this picture is really a cartoon. But it does help to understand what's going on when we talk about electrons and solids. So let's imagine this atom with the nucleus. We've got different shells here. I put 2 electrons in this shell and 8 electrons in this shell. And this outer one, I have 4. And the idea is that these are the core electrons. These electrons don't interact very strongly when 2 atoms come together. But these outer electrons, called valence electrons, do interact. And they're the ones that create the bonds that hold a crystal or a solid together. So if we take this particular schematic atom and we link it up in a two-dimensional array, of course, real materials except for graphene and a few other special cases are three-dimensional, we can satisfy all the bonds. And in this way, we have 2 electrons pictured here in this cartoon between each pair of atoms. And now we have our 8 electrons around this outer shell. So this is a completely satisfied structure, albeit a cartoon. And we picture the electrons' energy as follows. The core electrons are lower down. That means they're more stable. They're of lower energy. The electrons want to drop into the lowest available states. So these core electrons are down here. And on this energy diagram, they'd be at the bottom. Higher up, we have the valence electrons. And in this particular, what we call a band, it's full, the way I've drawn it here. All the bonds are satisfied. So this is where all the bonding electrons sit in energy. Then there's a gap. And up here, we have this, what I call a conduction band, which is empty. There are no electrons in that. So in this particular, that's not my phone, so. In this particular crystal, quote unquote, it would be an insulator, electrical insulator, because all the electrons are tied up either in core positions or they're in bonds. And there's no extra electron and there's no missing electron. So this is a cartoon of an insulator. Does that make sense in a very simple way? Okay. If we have the same picture here, but the bonds are weak, thermal energy, just the energy of the ambient, the energy of the vibrations in the solid, these atoms and electrons are vibrating, that is sufficient to break a very small number of bonds. And when a bond breaks, the electron becomes free to move throughout the crystal until it falls into another opening like this, a missing electron somewhere. So we would picture that in an energy diagram as follows. The core electrons, nothing happens here. The bonding electrons in the valence band are for the most part in bonds, but an occasional one can be excited up into the conduction band by just thermal energy, by vibrations. That now is free to move. It's a higher energy state, but it's free to move. So this would become conductive, and we would call this an intrinsic semiconductor. I mean, there aren't any impurities in it. It's still a pure crystal. So if I back up, for example, this would be diamond. It's basically an insulator. It takes too much energy to excite an electron or to break a bond, so it basically stays as an insulator. This would be silicon or germanium, where the energy that it takes to break the bond is much smaller, so thermal energy can be sufficient to break a small number of them. So if you put two contacts across a piece of germanium and you put a voltage across it, a very small current will flow, even if there are no impurities present.
When you said that now that the electron that goes up to the conduction point is free to move.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about electricity, are you actually saying, is the electricity considered the movement of electrons from point A to point B?
Yeah.
Is that a good way to think
about it? Yeah, and another thing that I would say is that some of the electrons can't move, right? They're stuck. It's only a very small fraction of the electrons typically that can actually move.
And if an electron moves from point A to point B, other electrons are coming in behind it to replace it?
Mm-hmm.
So we sort of never quite...
If you have a circuit, sure, yeah.
I really love these two slides. Is this concept of valence electrons, staying put or moving up, is it the same thing or analogous to the concept where visible light originates, where you excite the electrons and they go up to different SPDF things? They acquire some, they become excited and then drop down and emit photons?
That's coming. Yeah, it's related. I've skipped over a lot of stuff here.
Right.
But if you take an individual atom, like take this one away from this crystal, and you look at its electronic structure, in other words, its electron energy diagram, you'll see individual levels,
yeah.
Not a band, not a spread out set of levels. You just see one level.
Right.
And if you take an electron from this level and you put it up into this excited level, and then it spontaneously drops back down, it will emit light. It can, it doesn't have to, but it probably will emit light.
When this happens, does it emit a form of radiation, some form of energy?
That red spot on the wall?
Yeah.
It's exactly that. We've got a crystal of, I think it's aluminum gallium arsenide. It may be aluminum gallium arsenide phosphide, but it's something like that. It's a compound, it's a semiconductor. And when I press on this button, a voltage is put across that semiconductor that causes electrons to flow, and they recombine with holes, which are the missing electrons, and emit red photons. In this particular device, it's a laser, so it's a little more than that. It's what I just described is called a light-emitting diode. What this is a light-emitting diode with an optical cavity. There are two mirrors, one on each side, and that causes the light to come out in just one direction and to be coherent. As opposed to coming out everywhere, yeah, like an LED. If you look at the traffic light out there, now they've gone to LEDs as opposed to incandescent lights. So they're made out of semiconductors. Those emit in every direction. They have some optical elements in there to make sure that they don't, that you don't waste the light. Bring it, recycle it, essentially. Steer it in the direction you want. But if you had a laser if you had a series of lasers there, that wouldn't be very good. I mean, you'd only... First of all, your eyes would probably be damaged if you happen to see the light, but you normally wouldn't see it. So a little more complicated here. What if we stick an impurity on this site that has one extra electron? The example in silicon would be phosphorus. If you look on a periodic table, phosphorus is one column over. It's got an extra electron. When you stick it in and replace it for phosphorus, it has this extra electron in its outer shell. It doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't need it to bond. So that electron is basically free to move. It takes a little energy to get it to move. If you don't have any thermal energy, if you low temperature, say, it'll hang around in the vicinity of the phosphorus atom. But you just give it a little kick, and it'll pop up into the conduction band. That's called an extrinsic semiconductor. We added an impurity. That impurity caused it to conduct. And then we've got the metal. Now, in a metal, there are different ways. Actually, metals are the hardest things to describe. You'd think they'd be the simplest, but they're absolutely the hardest. In a metal, only a fraction of the bonds are satisfied. Or alternatively, you can think of there are many more electrons that are needed for bonding. So instead of just filling one of these bands, we have the band here, this conduction band, is half full. Or it might be a quarter full or a third full, but it's got a lot of electrons in it. And so this thing will conduct electrons easily. In this picture, I show quite a few extra electrons. I think I've got four or something like that per atom. And they are free to run around through the crystal. So this will be very conductive. Like, it is a metal. And you got to think, the reason I show these two kinds of pictures, this is your energy picture, and this is your real space kind of picture. It's a cartoon, but it does represent what's going on. And in science of materials, we have to constantly go back and forth. You have to have both pictures in your head. Actually, we have another picture that's called K-space or reciprocal space, and I won't go into that, but those pictures are in your head simultaneously. Okay, so electrons in nanostructured materials, this is where we get to this problem. Electrons can be considered to be both waves and particles. So you've heard that a lot. You may accept it. I barely accept it, but I'll show you how I think about it. If it were a particle, then its momentum would be its mass times its velocity, just like a baseball or a brick or something. Momentum equals mass times velocity. I'll use P for momentum. If it were a wave, then the momentum would be Planck's constant divided by the wavelength. So Planck's constant is H, lambda is the wavelength, if you think of a wave. Those are completely two different pictures. But in fact, they're not inconsistent. Missing a paren here, but they're not inconsistent. If you think of a particle or a wave, the kinetic energy is still P squared, the momentum divided by twice the mass. So if you think about a baseball, you put in mv here and you get 1/2 mv squared. But the same is true for a wave, an electron wave, you put in H over lambda, and you get the equivalent for a wave. So how do we reconcile these? Well, if you think of an electron as a particle, you really should think of it as an electron wave packet. So it's easier, in fact, I think, to think of the electron as a wave at all times. And instead of thinking, personally, that's the way I do it. I don't think of the electron as a particle. When I see it as a particle, I just think of it as a collection of waves. And how do you get that collection of waves? How do you confine the electron? You know, if you write a sine wave out, it goes on forever to negative infinity and positive infinity. So you really haven't confined anything. You haven't described anything that looks like a particle. But if you add up a bunch of different sine waves that have different periods, very slightly different periods, you will find that, or in this case, cosine waves, you will find that they reinforce each other at only one point, basically at the origin. And that they dampen out as you add them together as you move away from the origin. So in this picture here, I just took XL and made 20 different, or I put 10. Yes, 10 different cosine waves. And I plotted them each here with very slightly different periods or wavelengths. You add them up and you get this black curve. What does that say? Well, it says that the electron, and I'll get into this in a little more detail, is sitting somewhere, or not precisely at the origin, but is sitting somewhere in this vicinity. It's taken what are essentially infinite functions going off to negative infinity and positive infinity and giving you something that is finite. And the function, this black line, goes off to negative infinity or positive infinity, but it heads towards zero as you go out. And most of the amplitude is concentrated near the origin. So that's a wave packet. You can make it in XL or whatever. And that's what I think of as the particle. It's a wave packet. Now, let me go back just real quick. You've heard of the uncertainty principle? Okay, uncertainty principle says that the product of two conjugate properties, the uncertainty of two conjugate properties is greater than or equal to a constant, to H, more or less Planck's constant within a factor. If two conjugate properties would be the position, the uncertainty in position, and the uncertainty in the momentum. The uncertainty of the momentum could be related to the uncertainty in the wavelength. If you add up more of these sine waves, just gradually changing the period, you will find that the sum of them will gradually compress and become closer and closer to the origin. And that is essentially the uncertainty principle. The more uncertainty you have in the wavelength or the momentum, meaning the more sine waves you add up, the more you know the position. So that the uncertainty principle, you can just take Excel, add up a bunch of cosine waves to your heart's content, keep adding them, and see it in action. It just drops out of the summing the trig functions. So it's really not all that mysterious unless you think about it a little harder, and then it gets really confusing. Okay, well, electrons in nanostructured materials, each wave, we call it a wave function, is analogous to the shape of a vibrating string. And this is, I don't know. I mean, when I teach this, I usually go back to the vibrating string equation, which happens to look very much like what we know as Schrodinger's equation that describes quantum mechanics, describes the wave nature of electrons. And it's an interesting process to think about how the Schrodinger equation came about and what ideas led to that. But in reality, the mathematical structure of it is virtually identical to the vibrating string equation. The vibrating string equation describes the vibrations in a string, or for example, if you look at a jump rope while it's in motion, the vibrating string equation is basically describing the trajectory or the arc of that jump rope. If you're a musician, you would think about it as the vibrating string in your instrument. We talk about an envelope function, which is basically a description of a standing wave as a static envelope. But in fact, over time, it's going back and forth like this. And so we just talk about the envelope function as being static. So if we hold two ends of a string, like two ends of a jump rope, and we get it moving, we have nodes where the two people stand, which are basically places where the point doesn't move, where the string doesn't move. And it oscillates back and forth, up and down. Now, of course, in a jump rope, it might be going like this, but your view of it from here would look like that. If you just watched it took strobe photos, essentially, of it moving. You can do this. You can create this standing wave such that there will be an integer number of half wavelengths between two points, which are going to be the boundaries of our nanomaterial, essentially. Each half wavelength exists between two nodes. So you can imagine taking a jump rope, and if you're coordinated with the person who's at the other end, you can go out of phase, so you can get a node to form in the middle. You can get a zero point in the middle where the jump rope's just going like this. You may have done that before. It's not that hard to do. You do have to work a little harder, though. To get that extra node there, you have to move faster. And if you shorten your string or your jump rope, you have to move faster. So a general principle is that the shorter the wavelength, that is the shorter string or more nodes, the more energy it takes to vibrate the string. And the same thing's true for an electron. If we move the nodes closer together, the electron's energy increases. If we put an electron in a box, the walls of the box become nodes, first order. So the smaller the box, the higher the energy of the electron. And that's the principle of quantum confinement. If we squeeze on it, it takes more energy to get the electron into its standing wave state, and its energy goes higher. It's kinetic energy, essentially. Although it's standing, it's kinetic energy, if you want to think of it that way. Confining the electrons fundamentally changes their electronic structure. And that's what I mean by these materials are new materials. They're not the same as the bulk material. And the other thing that's nice is they're tunable with size. So you can make a million different new materials by just taking the same material and making it different sizes, making its diameter different. Each diameter is a different material. optical properties. Decreasing the size of the nanostructure material increases the energy difference between allowed energy levels. And we kind of already covered that because of your question earlier. But as you squeeze on the electron, its energy states change and move apart. So if you have a series of energy levels in your material and you squeeze on it, the energy levels spread out, mainly because of this effect of the, if you want to think of the jump rope, shortening the jump rope, you have to work harder, the energy's more, so the levels and the energy between the levels spreads out. So I call that delta E, the difference in the energy levels. When an electron drops from a higher energy state, because you've excited it there and then it drops back down, it can emit a quanta of light, and that would be a photon. This is conservation of energy. So if the electron gains energy by going to an excited state and then drops down, so that energy has to go somewhere. And it can go to the emission of a quantum of light or a photon. The wavelength of that light will be Planck's constant times the speed of light divided by the energy difference between the levels. Now, a larger delta E implies shorter wavelengths. So if you have confined your structure more, the energy levels spread out more. If you have an electronic transition from an excited state down to a ground state, it will emit a more blue-shifted color of photon, meaning a higher energy photon, because it's related to the reciprocal. So the wavelength is inversely related to the difference in energy. So what does this mean for quantum-confined materials? Here's our quantum dot again. If you take quantum dots like this and you make them different sizes, and it's kind of hard to see this picture here, but you can see this. If you make them different sizes, they either emit different colors or they absorb different colors. Depends on what kind of experiment you do. But the bottom line is they're optically different. So if you take a small cadmium selenide particle that's 5 nanometers in diameter and then another one that's 4 nanometers in diameter, and you hit them with ultraviolet light, with a laser, ultraviolet laser, you will see them luminesce, meaning emit light, corresponding to the energy levels, and one will emit, say, blue light, and the other one will emit green light. And these are vials, these are macroscopic, say, centimeter size, containing suspensions of nanoparticles, same material, but different sizes. And you can see their optical properties.
Smaller size on the left.
Well, it depends. In this particular case, I believe, in fact, I put a caption down here that decreasing size, but in fact, you have to be a little careful here. I have to go back and look and see, because if this is luminescence, then meaning light that's emitted because it's been stimulated, then yes, as we move from here to here, we're getting smaller. Particles are getting smaller because the energy levels are pulling apart and it's becoming more and more blue shifted. But if it's absorption, then it's the opposite, or it could be slightly different. So I have to qualify that. I'm not sure. But I think these are fluorescence. But what is this wave function? Okay, so I've talked about how you can think of a particle as essentially a sum of cosine functions with a range of wavelengths or momentum values. But that's kind of a mathematical abstraction. What I've plotted here in the blue is essentially what I had on the other figure, just that black part of the other figure where it shows this wave function sum of cosines. But what does that mean to you? I mean, what do you think of, if I tell you that an electron's a wave, what is that? How do you relate that to the particle picture? I mean, you might buy my argument that if you sum up the waves, you can get it to be spatially confined, and that's equivalent to the uncertainty principle. But what is a wave? What is a wave that has amplitude that goes negative and positive? I mean, this is something that students in chemistry, when they first learn about quantum mechanics, get so confused about, because you see these pictures of plus and minus, and you think, is that charge? Is it, what is it? It's amplitude. But the amplitude itself isn't something you can really grab onto. Maybe you can. I can't. Most people I know don't relate to the amplitude of the wave function. But it turns out if you square it and you multiply it by the electronic charge, E, so charge on electron is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. If you multiply that times the square of the wave function, you get what is essentially the probability density, or in this case, the charge density. Is where is the charge actually sitting? So this red plot here is the square of the wave function. It's just the square of this blue function. And it's positive everywhere, so we can, okay, well, that I can deal with. Something that's positive everywhere, I can, you know, I can be happier with that as a description of matter somehow. And in fact, what this says is that the likelihood of finding the electronic charge is high here. If you were to do an experiment where you went in to try and find out where the electron actually sits, it's high where you have these bumps, and it's low where you have the valleys. But probably more realistically, you should think of that charge as being distributed in space. It's not a point. If you did the experiment, you could go in and find, in principle, the electron somewhere in this space, and a probability of finding it here, here, or here is pretty high, but in between is low. But well, probably a better description is that it's actually distributed in space, this charge. It's not a point. Yeah. This is something I made on Excel. You know, it's a one-dimensional sort of line, no confinement. But in an electronic, in an atom, you have exactly the same equation that describes the wave function, Schrodinger's equation. The difference is here I don't have a potential, or the potential energy is flat for the electron. In an atom, you have a positively charged nucleus. So the electron is drawn in to the vicinity of that nucleus. And so the actual description of the waves that solve the Schrodinger equation are somewhat different. They might look more like a drumhead solution or something like that, because the potential is at a point, and the positive charge is at a point, and the electron is drawn in by Coulomb interaction to be close to that point. The electron is a negative charge. Nucleus has positive charge, they want to pull in together. So the wave functions that you're familiar with, S, P, D, F, the S is spherically symmetric, and it's a solution to the Schrodinger equation. It's like if you took a drum head and you hit it, one of the solutions is the whole drum head moving up and down together. Okay. If you look at the P orbital, it's out of phase on one side compared to the other. So the wave itself around the positive charge shows a positive lobe here and a negative lobe here. In time, they're switching back and forth. But if you just freeze it, you look at the envelope function, the side on the right side is positive, the one on the left is negative. That's like hitting a drum head and exciting the mode where half the drum head goes up while the other half goes down. That's the P orbital. So yeah, they're all, it's exactly the same, but the shape of the potential is different from what I show here. This is a simple flat potential, and it's one-dimensional instead of three-dimensional. That's the same idea. The electron's a wave in an atom, too. I showed those pictures with the electrons as dots, complete cartoon. I mean, that's sort of Lewis octet-related stuff that we still find useful. I mean, I think of it that way all the time, but it's not a physically accurate way to look at it. Of course, Schrodinger's equation is a model, too, and it may prove to be inaccurate down the road. Who knows? But for now, it seems to describe everything we need. So from a chemistry point of view, we're pretty happy with that. Okay, so I hope that didn't confuse you too much, but that's where it is confusing. So you're sort of at my level of confusion now. How does it work in a nanowire? Well, in a nanowire, we have a diameter that's comparable to a typical wavelength of a conduction electron, if it is comparable. It's not always comparable. 100 nanometers may be quite large compared to the electron wavelength. Depends on the material. In some materials, that would be close to a few electron wavelengths, in some semiconductors. In a metal, that would be much, much larger, and it would not be quantum confining. But if the diameter were down in the range of a few wavelengths of the electron, then it does become a quantum wire. So we talked about quantum dots. A nanowire becomes a quantum wire when it's constrained down to dimensions that are close to a few wavelengths of an electron. And that squeezes them in two dimensions, but they're free to move in the third. So that's what we have in a carbon nanotube, certainly. It's not a simple solid. It's actually wrapped around. But in a carbon nanotube, the electron is confined to be within the sheet. Okay, more or less within the sheet or on one side of it, but essentially confined by the sheet's thickness, the graphene layer's thickness. It's also confined in this direction because there's essentially what you call a periodic boundary condition. That is, it has to match up, the electron wave has to match up when it comes around to the other side, because you've put that period into the circumference, essentially, into the problem. So in order to satisfy that, it's essentially bound in two dimensions, even though it's a tube rather than a wire. The electron's pretty free to move in the plane. But it turns out that depending on how you line these things up, it may not be as free as you'd think. And that you only can find out by solving the Schrodinger equation. But the result is that if you have an armchair tube, which is this structure here, so you form the armchair, that would be holding it like this and wrapping it up like this. That's an armchair. And this is a 5-5. I won't go into the details, but it basically tells you how to line them up and what diameter it is. It's a 5-5 armchair tube. It's going to be a metal. That means the electrons can travel freely within the carbon nanotube. If we heat it up, the conductivity goes down. It's a metal. Not much, but it will go down a little bit. In a zigzag tube, where we've wrapped it up the other way, it becomes a semiconductor. What these pictures are, I'm not going to go into great detail here, but if you turn them on their side, they're more or less a picture like I showed you already. Now energy is in this direction. And what we have here is a gap. There are no electron states in this little teeny gap, or very few. And that's what makes it a semiconductor. It takes energy to excite the electron from below that gap to above the gap. Whereas up here, you notice that there are states everywhere. This is the density of states. There are states everywhere. So this is a metal. It's easy for the electrons to move. They're not all filled. Fermi energy's right here. That means it's the electrons are filled up to this point, and then they're empty up above. The states are empty above. So this can conduct. This one has a hard time conducting, but that's what you want. If you want to modulate the conductance of the material, you need it to be a semiconductor. If it's a metal, it's hard to get it to change its conductivity. It's more or less always conductive. So these materials, this is an actual picture of one, which is taken by a scanning tunneling microscope, where you take, I don't know if you've seen that yet, but you take a sharp probe atomic scale, and you pass it over a surface, and depending on what kind of a scanning probe it is, it might be measuring the electronic potential, essentially, at each point, or it might be writing over like a mechanical stylus. And this particular picture shows what a single-walled carbon nanotube. You can see its chirality is such that it's not pure armchair or zigzag. It's actually wrapped up a little bit off to be more like this, if you were to wrap it up. And this is a model of that particular carbon nanotube. This is what a single-walled carbon nanotube would look like spread out across two platinum metal electrodes. So if you want to measure the conductance of that electrical behavior of that carbon nanotube, you need to have contacts on both sides. So applications of nanostructured materials. I've got probably have another 5 minutes or so, but we can talk more if you'd like. There are lots of them. Fluorescent markers for biomedicine being explored right now. Structural reinforcement. We've talked about a little bit about conducting channels for future of electronics. I think you had a little bit on that by Professor Lundstrom. Tunable lasers and light-emitting diodes. Matter of fact, this laser actually is quantum confined. It's not a nanotube or nanowire. It's a quantum well. It's actually a thin sheet of semiconductor that's emitting the light. It is quantum confined. Quantum dots, nanotubes, and nanowires for sensors, and many more. But of course, what your students know about is nano pants and nano tennis rackets. And sure, there are some nanostructured materials in these, but of course, the main thing here is the hype, and let's sell a product. So I just want to throw that out, that nano is obviously an overused buzzword, and that's the price we pay. But in some cases, there's something to it. I think I wouldn't rule out that carbon nanotubes could improve materials used for tennis rackets. I have my doubts whether that's actually happening here. My son, who's a tennis player, thinks it is, but so he'll pay another $50. For his racket. I think I will skip because of time, and I think you may have seen this, and the view graphs are there. The application that probably jumps out at you is replacing silicon as the transistor material, integrating it with silicon, but making the transistor itself out of carbon nanotubes.
Has anyone ever looked at the advancement of nanotechnology? At the beginning of the talk, you said every couple of months they come up with better. Has anyone sort of plotted that in a sort of Moore's Law kind of way to see?
Well, what they plot mostly is the number of papers published, which goes up exponentially in the beginning. And it's probably not going up exponentially anymore. It's probably starting to be a, I would imagine it's more constant right now, but since the whole world's involved. But it's still increasing. I think that would be interesting. I don't know how to do that, but that would be... we're still in the mode where breakthroughs are needed. So it's not a linear thing or even exponential. It's just an event-governed thing. So
how far off do you think the point is where you'll be able to create nanotubes the way you want to at a length that is suitable?
Well, gosh, if you talk to some people, they say they can do it already, but the scientific community, I think, doesn't believe that quite yet. Might be 10 years off, might be 20 years off, might never happen. We don't really understand what we need to understand yet. We might be able to do it accidentally, but I don't think we understand yet. Matter of fact, let me skip to, because you can look at this yourself. How are they made? I'll spend just a minute on that at the end here. The real problem is a high surface to volume ratio of any of these things. They really don't want to form nanowires or nanotubes. The surface contributes excess surface free energy per unit area. So if you look at the lowest free energy state for any kind of solid material, if you allowed it to go to that point, it would be a spheroidal, especially if it's cubic, it would be a spheroidal structure with facets on it, but it'd be more or less a sphere, and it'd be one big sphere. So making something small is hard because the surface to volume ratio is high, and that adds excess energy, free energy. And making something of high aspect ratio is generally very hard because that's non-equilibrium. That's not what the structure wants to be. Generally, it wants to minimize its surface energy, and that usually means more or less minimizing surface area divided per atom basis. So we have to exploit kinetics. We have to figure out how to control rates of reactions if we want to make these things. And both for nanowires and nanotubes, the basic method, it's not the only method, but the basic method is catalysis. Take a small particle, maybe 2 nanometers in size, maybe iron, and put it in a vapor of the material you want to grow. It could be a silicon nanowire or it could be a carbon nanotube. So put it in propane or put it in silane. And if you design it right, you'll get the reaction to occur only at the interface with the nanoparticle. And if you do it that way, you can grow either a tube or a wire from a nanoparticle under conditions that would not normally allow you to grow anything. And that's because this acts as a catalyst, meaning that it lowers the barriers to reaction and is not consumed during a reaction. And there's a whole art to this, a little bit of science. And here we can make, for example, zinc oxide nanowires. The carbon nanotubes are almost all made by a process like this. It's not the best way to go, but it's something we've known how to do since 1964. It's been around for a while.
What's the limits now? How long?
Well, Richard Smalley, who's got the Nobel Prize for the Buckyball, who's at Rice University, I believe is trying to make meter lengths, but I think the longest I've seen that I've paid attention to have been in millimeter range, so which is actually pretty long if you think about how wide they are. You know, if you're talking about something that's a nanometer in diameter, to be a millimeter long is an awfully good aspect ratio. But I think Richard Smalley, if you cornered him, would tell you that he can make them any length you want. But I don't know if I believe that yet. He wants to make them go from here to the moon, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a lot of ideas. Some of them are really good. Some of them are a little out there, but he's got a Nobel Prize, so he can say whatever he wants. But no. He gave a talk here at Purdue, and he's given it at many universities on the future of energy, and part of it ties into what he believes is a scheme for moving electricity from one point to another with low loss, and that's basically carbon nanotube based. It seems way off, but. It I can't argue with the idea. I mean, the whole picture that he has is a very elegant picture. It may not come to pass, but it's worth looking at seriously. If you try to get a grant in nanotechnology, and if it's a big grant, there better be a societal impact, you know, beyond technology aspect to it, either, you know, ethics or health or something like that, because these issues can kill a technology. It could be a very promising technology, but fear itself, even separate from what's really the issue might be from a scientific point of view, the fear of it could prevent it from going forward. So the scientists are, I think, much more aware now of why they have to pay attention to these things ahead of time rather than waiting till after it's all done. So it is a huge issue. I haven't seen anything that convinces me that there is a real problem yet, but there could be. It's way too early, I think, to rule that out.
Is your exposure, you're in a good question. You sit there in a lab where they're making bucket balls, in a furnace or whatever. Mm-hmm. You open up the furnace and goes this carbon. Is that carbon that goes poof, you know, up into the room, up into the air, any different than the carbon that you're exposed to? Size-wise, it's different, but is it different from the carbon you're exposed to in the fireplace when you...
Well, it probably is, but your point is really good in that in our lab and most labs in modern universities and certainly in industry are much safer than your kitchen. And so we wouldn't open up the furnace and let it go poof. You know, if we did have to open it up and expose ourselves to it, we would be gowned up and masked up. Even if we don't know what the hazard is, we would still do that. Now, in the case of diesel exhaust or smoke from your fireplace, I'm sure there were some. You know, I'm not an expert in it, but I'm sure there are some nasty things in there that are probably as bad. But the problem with the carbon nanotubes and with all these small things that are free anyway, they're so small. I mean, I think that's really the issue. Is they're in a different regime. So the soot particles would be mostly much bigger than that.
Yes.
But there might be some that are small like that.
Can I ask you what your protocol is in your lab or the labs here in Purdue when they extract the carbon out of the furnace?
Well, we don't do it that way. So I should qualify that. It's not all that. In my lab, we don't grow carbon nanotubes. We grow nanowires, and we do it within a template. And we actually never release them. But I collaborate with people who make carbon nanotubes by CVD, where they actually grow them on a substrate and they leave them on a substrate. If they remove them, they remove them in solution. It's not a dry process.
Is there a process by which you make it, by like a plasma electric arc or electric plasma arc?
Yeah. Yeah. We use a what's called plasma enhanced chemical vapor deposition. So it's like the same technique that's used to grow silicon films. And for microelectronics. But they grow as wires or carbon nanotubes in a forest, kind of on a substrate. But your point is good, because when you open up the chamber, you've got them not all just where you want them. Some of them are places you don't want them.
Right.
And you need to wear, and I don't know in that particular lab what their protocol is, because I don't go in there, but I'm sure they're masked up at least when they do that. I think the hazard level is relatively low compared to what you might imagine as a poof or something. It's not that kind of a thing. But it's still an issue. I think one has to be very careful with that. Yeah. I'm sorry, I could find out what their protocol is. But
I hung out in a lab that did that on a private site. It was like a little room, and they were just making stuff. And it's like that was one person's job, was to not only make it, but to... You know, clean out the furnace and take the material over.
That would scare the dickens out of me. I don't know.
I was scared. I mean, sort of being there and thinking about it.
When the only thing that's close to that in my experience, and I don't do it in this particular lab that I'm in, but when I was at Berkeley, we had a film deposition system that created some debris. It wasn't particles of the, probably not of that scale, but they were. There was certainly some dust that came out of it. And normally we would not open it up. But when we did have to open it up, we had respirators on and gowns. And
we had dust masks.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I can't comment on that specific lab.
But I thought at the time.
It's a problem. I mean, I think that the problem is when you get into a new field, the last thing you think about is a safety issue.
Yeah.
And then later on, you know, typically you start worrying about it. I think we're at the stage now where I'd hope that most people doing work in this area are really sensitive to that. Even though we don't know what the hazards are exactly, you've got to assume that they are hazardous. I mean, I personally would treat them like asbestos. I mean, I don't know. I mean, that would be my gut reaction. But I'm not an expert in it. I'd still, with the carbon nanotubes, I'd still worry a little, even if someone told me they were okay, because they're so small. You know, it's just... But you're right. I mean, in your everyday existence, you do things that are probably much more hazardous than that, even if they were hazardous. I mean, you just think about what you're exposed to on a day-to-day basis. But still, we have to be careful, and we don't want to blow it. So.
I always wondered about it.
Yeah, I wonder about it, too.
I actually had blood work done for something else when I left, and they actually found that my liver enzymes were totally wiped out.
Yeah, that's not good.
It might not be related, but it was like, it's not like I had a lifestyle that promoted elevated liver enzymes and stuff.
Now, we have to be careful. There are heavy metals that we use in the laboratory that we have to be very careful with, and as we are much more careful in the lab with those heavy metals than we are in our kitchen. I mean, nowadays people are more careful with mercury, for example, and they don't really have mercury anymore. But 20 or 30 years ago, you were not careful. And in a laboratory, even then, people were a little more careful, probably more cavalier than they should have been, but more careful than they were in the kitchen. Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, some of you have probably done that. Yeah, I think I did. I remember doing that.
I don't know, you're the one I would direct this to or not, but in reading the book that was given to us about nanotechnology, they talk quite a bit about DNA and coding DNA.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If they start using that in various aspects for relaying information from one place to another, what keeps that from degrading along the way? Because it's fairly sensitive to start with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert in that, but I work with people who do that kind of thing, and matter of fact, there are a couple of people here at Purdue who take essentially DNA molecules and use them to code structures to build up materials. So Chengdi Ma is one I'm thinking of, where he can order or synthesize a DNA strand that has a certain base pair sequence that will allow him to or make them form networks. So they'd be maybe cross grids or a triangular grid on a substrate. And then you can attach molecules to the cross points, for example, and build up structures that you couldn't build up other ways. But I understand.
These are from Monday, by the way.
But there are different. Well, I mean, I'll just as a precursor, I mean, I really am not an expert in this, but I know that there are DNA-like molecules that aren't DNA, that have the same kind of properties, but they're built up, I think it's with, I better not speculate, but they have different backbone materials than DNA, and they're more stable, and they're not useful for generating life forms, but they have the same coding behavior. And I think a lot of the people working on nanomaterial synthesis using DNA are actually using those molecules rather than the organic version of DNA.
Well, I mean, we worry about mutations because of stray energy running through to keep it from being completely disoriented by some kind of stray energy that just happens to run through that particular lab that day.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of if you're using it to make a material, if you're using it to, that's essentially what I'm referring to, is you can strengthen some of those bonds by substituting other elements in for the elements that are normally in organic DNA.
So it's not the base itself, it's the outer, the
well, I think the bases are very, they're both important, but the sugar backbone can be substituted and strengthened thermally and would also be stronger with respect to radiation. But I asked, who's the speaker? Is it Albina Ivanisevic? Oh, we're going to have both. Well, Chengde Mao, the one I mentioned, is the one who makes these networks. So you've got the expert coming here. And Albina makes DNA nanowires, so she also could answer any of those questions. So I'll leave it to them. It's a good question, though. Interesting area.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask
on nanotubes on their stream.
Mm-hmm.
Which way is the dominant, and how's it been?
In terms of strength?
Yeah, like tensile compression.
Yeah, I think, I believe that the ideal strength has been measured, or close to the ideal strength, around a terapascal in terms of modulus. That is the amount that it deforms with as a function of the essentially the force you apply to it. So that's pulling on it. That's tensile strength. But I know there are people working on what am I thinking of here? It's not shear, but the torque. Yeah, torquing it, and the that strength has also been measured and found to be the modulus has also been measured and found to be dependent on the chirality. So when I mentioned in the beginning that the mechanical properties, the fact that these things can be made essentially defect-free, means that you can explore the ideal mechanical properties. That is getting a lot of attention now because it allows you to check your models for how atoms bond. So we have models that describe bonding, and we can build these things up in a computer and test what the tensile strength should be, and there's a term I'm forgetting related to the torque, the modulus associated with the torque. It'll come to me. But you can predict what those should be, and now you can measure them. In other real materials, bulk materials, you can't do that.
Is there a difference between the zigzag and the armchair and the chair?
I don't know how much difference there is in terms of the tensile strength. I happen to know, because a former student of mine is working on this problem, that there is a difference in the twist, essentially.
What's the emphasis of your work? Better ones faster?
Mm-hmm. The emphasis of my work is in energy conversion devices. So we're taking these nanomaterials and trying to build more efficient energy converters with them as nanocomposite materials. So there are two major areas that I work in. One is thermal energy conversion. It's taking waste heat and converting it to electrical power using nanostructured materials. And another one is in white light emitters. So basically replacing incandescents and fluorescent lights with white-emitting LEDs, light-emitting diodes, and those are nanostructured. Our version of it is a nanostructured, nanowire-based or nanorod-based approach. So most of my projects right now are in that area. That interests me. It's always interested me. In 1980, I got interested in photovoltaics and solar cells, and that was when I graduated from college, I'm sorry. And the energy conversion thing has always fascinated me. So I'm not working on photovoltaics, but there are a lot of interesting problems out there. Not, you know, with the white light emitters, if we were successful in making LEDs that emitted high-quality white light, you can get a white LED now, but the quality of the light is pretty poor. You know, the projections are that would save something like, I think it's 4,000 power plants that would not have to be built. It would knock the energy consumed for lighting in the U.S. down by 33%. So you know, talk about all the hydrogen economy and all this other stuff, but if you could nickel and dime our way down with conservation and better technology, you're going to make a big dent. In terms of waste heat conversion, we're looking at nanostructured materials for taking exhaust heat from your car and converting it to electrical power that's fed back into the alternator and may replace the alternator eventually. Working with it's a DOE, Department of Energy funded project with BMW and a company called BSST and another company called Visteon, and we're a subcontractor for that, looking at the material side. And the reason we're excited in that is that those thermal to electrical direct energy conversion materials have been around since the 1950s. If you buy a beer cooler at Walmart or a soda cooler, whatever you drink, one of the plug-in kind, it's got a thermoelectric device in it, a Peltier cooler. And their efficiency has stayed low. Their niche applications, like a cooler, efficiency stayed low for 30, 40 years. But just in the last couple of years, nanostructured materials have come along and have doubled the efficiency in the lab, even tripled it. And they're not implementable yet, but they're getting there. So that opens up new avenues like waste heat conversion in automobiles. The Navy's interested because they want to get rid of the steam plants on their nuclear subs and their ships. They want to go directly from nuclear energy thermal energy created by a nuclear reactor to electrical power. They don't want the, you know, the hassles of running a steam plant in between. So that's my particular area of interest at the moment in terms of applications.
An electron which moves ballistically is one which primarily has particle-type behavior?
Well, you think of it then as a wave packet. If you want to think of it as a particle, you can too. But it moves without scattering for some distance. And in general, that will happen in most conductive materials. There's some length over which it will move before it scatters. But usually that length is very short. And if you have a carbon nanotube that's defect-free, it can be the length of the tube. So it really changes the physics quite a bit. It means that we can't use all of our models that are based on scattering.
So it becomes a waveguide for the packet?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah.
One way to think about that is if it's a perfect tube and you have an atom to every say, one nanometer, if you can get the wavelength to match that, then the thing just goes surfing down that perfect wave. Whereas if you have defects, then you get scattering at the defects. Perfection helps in the ballistic. Sorry.
No, that's right. That's a good way to put it. Exactly.
That's all related to the notion of increasing efficiency of devices and all those kinds of things, if you can accomplish that.
Yeah, if a ballistic electron moves much faster than an electron that's scattering about. So, that would speed up a device. But the problem is we really only understand how to make devices that are, at least industrially, that are involve scattering. So one of the problems in silicon technology is that even without carbon nanotubes, as you decrease the length of the silicon channel, how far the electron has to move between what we call the source and the drain, it's already getting ballistic, into ballistic regime in that. And there's some slides that I skipped over, but basically silicon technology, even without carbon nanotubes and nanowires, is already down in the nanoscale. And you start to see these things like ballistic transport. So what do you do? Gosh, now you have to redo your physics. You know, it's, I guess, in principle simpler, but it's something that the industry isn't familiar with dealing with, and it may mean that you have to change the device radically to make it work. So it may mean that it won't work. So those are concerns. But generally, the idea is exciting that we could make materials that don't scatter. The same thing is true for phonons. You know, do you know what a phonon is? It's a quanta of lattice vibrations. So it's a lattice vibration wave. Essentially, if you have a lattice that you think of balls connected by springs, and you push on one end, you'll launch a wave down the crystal. That can be called a phonon or a quantum of lattice vibration. In a carbon nanotube, you can launch a phonon wave from one end of it, and it can propagate without scattering all the way to the other end. And that's kind of the ultimate conductor of heat, because these phonons are what conducts heat through a lattice. Electrons conduct them heat too, but these carry a significant amount of heat. And it's one reason a carbon nanotube can be a very good thermal conductor, is that it doesn't scatter phonons.
Can I ask you, go back and ask you a question about electricity?
Sure, I'll try.
Yeah.
Try to answer it.
Is it possible for you to put that slide on electrons and solids where you're talking about metal?
Yeah, I'll see if it will pop back up here. My computer went to sleep here. I can tell this is going to be a hard question.
It's
so listen, okay. If it's really basic, it's going
to
be hard.
Talk to somebody who knows what they're talking about, so they can explain.
Uh oh. Now I'm on the spot.
I always struggle with trying to tell my kids or explain to my kids what electricity is. So you have your electrons that are in the conduction phase, free to move. From say left to right. The only way to get it to go left to right is that you've created some potential.
That's right. The only way to get the net flow in one direction is to do that. They're moving around in all directions, but yeah.
Okay. And that potential comes from a power plant.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
The
power plant's not creating electrons.
No, but it's moving them.
Right. from the interaction between the magnets and the conductor, the generator is basically creating this potential. Basically, at the power plant, it creates this really high potential. And over there in your house is a low potential, so the electrons then move in that direction.
That's a good description of DC, a direct current.
Right.
But, of course, we have an AC situation. But yeah, that's basically right. Yeah.
All right, let's say that it's DC.
Yeah, that's it's fine.
Better, right?
Me too.
And this might be it. If I was a kid, I'd ask this, like, why don't we run out of electrons? All the electrons are moving in that direction. Why don't we, like, run out of the ones that are moving?
Well, they're running in a loop. That's why. They're not running. They're not coming out one in.
They're coming back to the power plant.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. They're running in a loop.
Oh, man. There you go.
Might be a ground loop, but you should think of it as running in a loop. There's a circuit, you know, like when you draw the little diagram of a circuit or you do wiring in your house or something like that. At least that's the way I think of it. They're running in a circle.
Did you guys know that?
Did you ever think about it that way?
Well, it's like the power plant's taking them, or a battery, for example, is bringing them up in potential energy and then letting them go, you know, and they're sort of coming around.
Yeah. Well, I know, but I never really applied that point to the power plant.
I mean, if there wasn't a circuit, electrons could flow from the power plant to your house, and they sort of piling up there and making a big charge, and that would keep others from getting there.
I just thought they kept going to other homes and stuff.
Eventually they had to get back.
It is confusing. I get a kid. My father-in-law is a really good electrician. I mean, that's not his job, but he loves to do it. And I always am amazed at how much he understands about electricity without having any fundamental understanding of what's going on. He's much quicker than I am. He understands all that stuff. I have to think about. I have to come up with these models of how this. For him, it's wired into his brain. He knows. He understands all that. He knows where the electrons are going. He may not talk about them that way, but. You know, he knows if they're going into ground or if they're, you know, I don't have an intuitive feel for that, but talk to an electrician and they will know all this stuff, whether they can describe it, I don't know, but.
But it talks about electricity wasn't so much the move, like just the flow of electrons, but it was the change of the electric field, the movement of the electric field. It's talking about like the electrons only move like centimeters per second or something like that within the wire.
Well, they actually move much faster than that. Something like maybe 10 to the 7th, I think, is centimeters per second.
The drift velocity is very small.
Yeah.
You're thinking about something like that.
That's what I understand. That's
oh, I see. Okay.
And then this electricity, that's
so, I don't know, do you want to answer that? Maybe. Well, the electrons, they're between scattering events, they're moving very, very fast. But the question is on, I think, in a wire, for example, if you could tag an electron, how long does it take to get from one side to the other? I don't have a good number for that, but it's certainly slower.
It's very slow. You can walk faster than it.
See, that's... That's where I'm getting stuck at.
Well, an electron moving over here pushes another one out over here. Yeah, that's probably the better way to think of it.
It's like a water hose full of water.
Yeah.
The water molecule enters one end, doesn't come out the other end for quite a while. But water comes out the other end right away because the tube is already full. So when you turn the hose on, when you turn the spigot on, water comes out the other end immediately. But it's not the water that's going into the hose. That makes sense?
Yeah. Well, it did me. I don't know what you're doing.
And the scattering is just analogous, sort of like Brownian motion. As you push stuff in one end, it comes out the other, and it's the lattice sort that ultimately restricts the drift velocity or whatever you said.
And of course, in AC, they're sloshing back and forth. So that's.
I don't want to call it AC/DC. Misunderstood. I'm ready for about 1915 now. Let's don't push it.
Yeah, actually, this talk was 1930, so, yeah.
On the atoms, and that one, first time around, were you talking about where we're showing a would that be more like a covalent bond?
Yeah, the cartoon there, if you wanted to turn that into a description, a more realistic description, each pair there would be an electron pair, single covalent bond. Yeah.
So, and this will also have problems, is like in the books, when you start jumping into that metallic.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to talk about it in terms of metal.
Mm-hmm.
How does that really differ? I mean, all I've ever seen in the textbook to see about one paragraph, it says it's where they pull electrons.
Mm-hmm. Where they pull them?
That's
the metallic bond?
Yeah, they're all pulled together, and as a, like, so everybody shares.
Oh, the sea of electrons. Yeah, yeah.
Freely wafting about.
Yeah. I mean, maybe Nick has a better description, but it's a very problematic state of matter, I guess you'd say. One way to look at it is that it's like a covalently bonded solid, but then there aren't enough electrons to complete the bonds, so that allows the electrons that are in bonds to move around. That's not a very appealing way to look at it, but it's one way to look at it. You can also look at it that there are all the bonds are satisfied, but then there are some additional electrons that don't have anywhere to go, so they run around the... You know, and they're there because there's a compensating positive charge on the nucleus. So it's not that you have an excess electron or negative charge. They're balanced, but they don't form bonds that are permanent. They that are long lasting. They run around the crystal. So I don't know. That one's easier to describe, but I don't really have a. I mean, I've taught that stuff before, and that when you get to the metallic bond, it. You typically give about three or four different pictures and let people pick things that they like. I think either of those is probably as good as you can do without getting into a lot of detail.
Now, I was going to ask this, it's a little off the nanotop matter, like nanotube stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But did the program of material science a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
But when talking about defects,
mm-hmm.
it seems like they had like a little bar of, I think, either lead or nickel, and you could bend it,
mm-hmm.
and you would hear a popping noise.
Mm-hmm.
And they described that. What was, it says like atoms jumping from defect and like the defects moving, or I don't know if that's your area.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of an easy way or trying to think of that experiment you're describing. If you maybe go back to the basics. If you take a metallic bar, something that's deformable that you can bend and will not spring back, as soon as you bend it such that it won't spring back when you let go, won't spring back all the way, that's called plastic deformation. And what happens during plastic deformation in most materials is that a dislocation, which is essentially a line defect, moves through the crystal. And actually, a lot of them move through the crystal. One way to think about it is if you have a carpet or a rug on your floor and you want to move it, what's the easiest way to move it? Do you just pull on it, or do you set a wave going that will allow you to easily move it? Well, you set a wave in motion if there's no one to help you, and that allows you to pull on it and make an incremental motion of the carpet without having to exert too much energy. Essentially, that's what a dislocation is. It's if you imagine a crystal, well, I probably can't do it with this, but if this were a three-dimensional crystal, it's one way to think of it is an extra half plane. It's like you shoved an extra plane of atoms, but it's terminated along this line. And that termination line is called the dislocation core. And that can move left or right much easier than cutting the crystal in half and then picking it up and moving it over one unit. It's easier to take that dislocation, that extra half plane, and propagate it along here, essentially just moving the line. And along that line, the bonds are disrupted and broken, but they're along one specific line rather than trying to break an entire plane to move one half over. So the net result is the same. I don't have the right graphics here, but if you were to take this extra half plane, stick it in here, break the bonds here, and then push it over, you'll end up displacing this part of the crystal over to here. You'll see these atoms here, or lines of atoms lined up over here. That's as if you had cut the crystal here, picked it up, and moved it over. To cut the crystal and pick it up and move it over is really hard to do. You have to break all the bonds in that plane. To move a single half plane over one slot, you just have to break the bonds along one line rather than along a whole plane. So what happens when you deform a crystal by bending it, or a crystalline material, it could be polycrystalline, it could have a lot of grains that are different orientation, but when you bend it, if you look at it in an electron microscope, you'd see dislocations moving across. And sometimes they pile up enough so that you see what are called slip lines. I don't know if you've seen that on the surface. They become macroscopic. You can see them pile up of the residue. All the extra sheets of atoms on the half plane create a step on the surface. So that can be seen with the eye in some cases. But what you're hearing when you bend it, and I have to be careful here because there's a lot of other deformation mechanisms, but I think you're hearing the dislocations move and launch phonons, essentially lattice waves, into the crystal, which ultimately deform air molecules at the surface, and that wave propagates and you pick it up in your ear. But well, there are a lot of other things that can happen, not just dislocations. There are materials called shape memory alloys that undergo phase transformations when you bend them or heat them up. So actually the crystal structure can change, and that can have a similar kind of effect. It can definitely make an audible sound. So there's a lot of deformation mechanisms, but most of them are dislocation-based. I mean, you can bend, if you take a copper bar and you don't bend it too far, it'll spring right back. You haven't moved any dislocations. It's elastic deformation. But if you bend it too far, then it doesn't bend back all the way. Then you know you've moved dislocations in the crystal.
I don't want to be greedy, but what about piezoelectric? Mm-hmm. When you bend a crystal, how do you generate that crystal, and then how do you generate that electricity? And then the converse, we're using it to run these, you know, atomic force microscopes.
Right.
So how does the reverse process work? Mm-hmm. Is that a doable explanation?
Yeah. In a piezoelectric crystal, you have a situation where the positive ions can move relative to the negative ions. So if you deform the crystal, if say it's got positive ions and negative ions, like lead and oxygen, lead would be the positive with the cation, oxygen would be the anion. If the crystal structure is such that if you deform it, the positive ions all shift relative to the negative ions, then you create electric polarization. And that can manifest itself a number of ways. The direct and converse piezoelectric effects that you just talked about are basically the see if I can get this straight. The converse is the one where you put an electric field on a piezoelectric crystal. It separates the positive and negative charge, and it changes shape to accommodate the separation of the titanium or the lead and the oxygen. It'll actually change shape macroscopically. The direct piezoelectric effect would be to apply stress to that crystal to bend it or whatever, and that would create an electric potential that would cause the positive and negative ions to separate, and you could actually put a circuit and see the current flow to compensate for that in the external circuit. So these things are used everywhere. You don't realize it, but you've got a lot of them in your car. You can buy piezoelectric skis if you want, because you know they can dampen the vibration. So the piezoelectric material in the ski, when it chatters, when it starts to bounce and vibrate, it has there's a circuit in this thing through the piezoelectric material or across the piezoelectric material, and when it deforms, it sends current through, but the circuit has some, the way I picture it, has some resistors in it, and the current can't just, or capacitors, and it can't flow easily. And it stiffens the material as soon as you try to bend it, is what is a feedback system in there. But yeah, in an atomic force microscope, you've got piezoelectric crystals, most of which are actually pyroelectric too, which is when the crystal, without it doing anything to it, already has a dipole moment in it. So the positive ion is already separated from the negative ion. And if you, maybe you've done this experiment, but there are some natural crystals in, think of the name of them, but tourmaline or something like that, mineral. Put it in a furnace and then take it out and it'll shock you. Because what happens is piezoelectric material, or the pyroelectric material with a spontaneous dipole, if it's been sitting around a lot, the charge will flow, ions or electrons, and will compensate for the dipole moment. It'll neutralize it. So when you touch it, you don't feel anything. It's still there, but there's no charge imbalance. You put it in a furnace, and that causes the crystal to change shape. It causes the dipole moment to change magnitude. And if you don't have any way for the electrons or other ions to flow to compensate for that quickly, and you go in and grab it, you'll get a shock.
What's the name of that?
I want to say tourmaline, but I probably...
Tourmaline?
Okay, you know, yeah, got it backwards.
What's the name of the property?
That's called pyroelectricity, yeah. It's related to piezoelectricity. We worry about those materials. We use them a lot, and we worry about them a lot. Turns out the materials that make the green traffic lights are LEDs, light-emitting diodes, made out of gallium nitride. And gallium nitride is both pyroelectric and piezoelectric, and that changes the quantum confinement. Turns out the electrons in the quantum well, we call it, experience an electric field due to that pyroelectric effect, and it shifts the wavelength of emission, makes them, in that case, more red than they would normally be. And it's kind of it's actually a problem, but you have to take it into account when you model it.
This is a whole realm of material science I've never had any contact with.
Well, one message I can give you, and this is with my MSE hat on, material science and engineering. I have a bunch of hats, but that's one. That's my where I came from. High school students don't know it exists for the most part. They come to Purdue or any other university, and they usually discover it too late. They usually, if they take the introductory class, they love it, but they usually don't know about it when they come. If they wanted to work in materials, they usually know chemical engineering is where to go. But in fact, most big universities have material science departments, which are probably the place to go. Now, I came into material science with an undergraduate degree in engineering physics, and I would argue, and I think Nick would agree with me, that a physics or chemistry or biology background is probably even better place to start. But for me, I went to graduate school in materials. But I think it's a fascinating field.
I mean, just even what you said sounds to me like it's ripe for a materials word module that we could teach at some point in time. I could see kids responding to this stuff. I mean, they all know about piezoelectric effect just even from lighters.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I think it's something we can attach on to.
Yeah, I think you could do a good one in that.
It's an awareness level of function. Mm-hmm.
Does that already exist? I don't know if there is one on piezoelectricity. It would be a good one, and there are a lot of experiments. A spark igniter, yeah, they'd love that. But there are a lot of things one could do with it. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the major holdup on the white LED?
Well, the white LED, the major holdup, I think, and I may have a different view than a lot of people, is it. You need to get emitters of different colors on the same substrate. And in order to get emitters of different colors, it's not just two different colors. You need a spectrum that matches the solar spectrum. So you need, red through blue. And the problem is there is no one material system yet, one platform that emits light efficiently over all that spectrum. This laser is made out of aluminum gallium arsenide, and if you add some phosphorus to that system, you can make colors from the infrared through to amber. So if you go and look at the traffic lights, the amber and the red LED lights are from this material system. But you can't make blue out of it, and you can't make green out of it. There's another material system, which I mentioned, the gallium nitride system, which you can make ultraviolet, so the very high energy photons that you can't see. You can make blue, and you can make green, but you can't make red and amber. So if you go to Times Square or you see it up and down 65 or any highway, you see now LED-based signs, these really brilliant signs that are huge, it's building size that you can see in direct sunlight. That's where they've taken the trouble to take a red LED and a blue LED and a white LED, all different color LEDs, cheap white ones, I'll describe those in a moment, and they essentially wire them together. That's very expensive. That will never make a cheap white light. It makes it a very expensive white light, but a sign, but not something that would replace incandescents. So the challenge is to get them all on one cheap substrate, all colors. The way that we're doing it right now, the community is doing it right now, is they're taking a blue LED, gallium nitride LED, and they're putting an epoxy dome on it, which is a standard LED package. I don't know if you've ever taken one apart. It's basically a transparent epoxy dome-shaped structure with a little teeny crystal in it. It's about 300 microns in size, so a third of a millimeter. And that's where the light's being emitted, is this little crystal with two electrodes on it. But it's embedded in a polymer or in an epoxy. And within that epoxy, if you put a yellow phosphor, that is a material that when it's you hit it with blue light, it emits yellow light. Then what you see, if you make that yellow phosphor partially transparent, some of the blue light comes out and some of the yellow light from the phosphor comes out that's been excited by the blue. And that combination of yellow and blue to your eye looks white. The problem is your eye perceives it as white, but if you tried to read with it or look at a piece of art with it, there's no red component to it, so you wouldn't see the red. I mean, in fact, you see a little bit because the yellow spectrum's broad, but it's a very poor white source. We measure that with something that's called the color rendering index, and it's basically how close does it match the solar spectrum. And these things are poor, but they're cheap. If you want to go buy a headlamp for climbing or a flashlight, LED flashlight, it'll be a white LED of that sort. And if you look at it carefully, you can see, or put it on the wall, you see blue and yellow. And if you change the power or change the time, in other words, look at it a year later, you'll find that the color's shifted, and it's not good. They're cheap, but they're not good. So now they're looking at UV LEDs, gallium nitride still, with multicolor phosphors, very expensive multicolor phosphors. Now we're talking about something that looks more like a fluorescent light. We've got a high-energy source, and then we've got the inside there is coated with some very sophisticated phosphors that give you the appearance of almost a solar-like light. You remember, old fluorescents were really bad that way. They did not match any suitable spectrum. They were white, but they looked cold, and you know, they're really disturbing. And a modern fluorescent really isn't that bad. It's pretty nice. But it's got some pretty nice phosphors in it. So now the LED version looks like that. The problem is you're using a UV photon, which is a high-energy photon, to create a red photon or a yellow photon, which is a low-energy photon. Where does that extra energy go? It's lost to heat. So they're not as efficient as they might be. So what we're doing in our lab, and other people are trying to do this as well, is figure out a more efficient way to use the electrons that are pumped up by the power plant, essentially, to more efficiently generate light. And I think it's doable, but it's a 10 to 15 year project. Still, even without our fancy LEDs that we're working on in the lab right now, which are nanostructured, you will see a certain amount of technology replacement. They're just more convenient. And the reason they're in traffic lights is they're 75%, or they use 25% of the electricity of an incandescent. But of course, they're generating a single color, which is what LEDs do best. And the other factor that's even more important is they last 15 years. And if you go to incandescent light, has to be replaced every year, even if it doesn't burn out, because you don't want a traffic light going out. So that means you have to hire a crew or bring a crew in on a cherry picker every year to replace the bulb, and that's expensive. If you put an LED light up there, unless some kid throws a rock at it, it's going to last 15 years. And it's not going to die catastrophically. It'll just fade away. But so now you're talking about taking a building, a new building, not right now, but in a few years, and instead of designing fixtures that are kind of designed to be reached and, you know, with bulbs in them, you can build the lighting in architecturally. You don't have to worry so much about maintenance. In principle, you can make mood lighting, too. You could have a pad that represents the color spectrum, and you could say, I feel like I want a warm light today. So you just press the pinkish light or the reddish light or whatever. So there's all sorts of new markets for it that, you know, you see the taillights and the interior lights in automobiles now are more and more turning to LEDs. The headlamps will eventually be LEDs. You know, they will replace, it's almost certain that those things will be replaced. Whether they become the basic lighting technology is the big question. That's where the energy savings would really come in.
And those just burn out a piece at a time, right? One little bulb, a couple at a time, or is it?
No, certainly there are modes where they can fail catastrophically, but when I say they have a 15-year lifetime, I'm talking about the intensity dying out over time. Usually they don't go catastrophically. Lasers do go catastrophically, but LEDs are it's a little more gentle death. But we're talking about 15 years, not 1 year.
What exactly is it on the crystal that goes bad? I mean, when you talk about dying out.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. The contacts can oxidize, and the resistance can go up. In a laser and in some cheap LEDs, the lasers are pumped a lot harder, so they're more susceptible. You get what's called a dark line defect, which is imagine this: you have a dislocation, like they talked about before, in your crystal. When the electrons and holes, when electrons are pumped up in the LED electrically, so that they can fall back down and emit photons. If the electrons pumped up near a dislocation, it won't emit a photon. It'll recombine at the dislocation defect, and it'll emit heat. So all that energy goes just to lattice heat. If that happens too much, it heats up the lattice. That causes the dislocation to become mobile. When a dislocation becomes mobile, it can multiply. So pretty soon you get this thermal runaway effect where the one dislocation becomes many, and so it absorbs more of the electrical energy and creates more heat, and eventually it'll melt. It'll just vaporize. It'll poof. It's gone. So that's what happens if you push a laser too hard. That's a solid-state laser, like a semiconductor laser. That's what'll happen when it dies. It'll probably melt. Poof. Anything else? I'm happy. I mean, I don't know what your schedule is. I'm happy to stay as long as you want, but
I think you can answer. I've always had this question, and no one at my school can help me with it. So you talked about the continuous spectrum from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
The sun's made up of hydrogen fusing to become helium.
Mm-hmm.
The emission spectrum of hydrogen and the emission spectrum of helium is well known.
Mm-hmm.
And they're discontinuous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whatever name they give them. So if the emission spectrum is discontinuous from these two elements which make up the sun, how do we get a continuous spectrum for visible light, Roy G. Biv?
Well, you've got what is essentially a nearly black body radiator. So it's not you have those effects, and Nick can probably speak more eloquently than I can on this, but you have certainly discrete lines coming from any material that is undergoing electronic transitions. But you also have radiation, black body radiation, coming from the hot source that has a spectrum that is more continuous. So it's not, I think those are two different kinds of radiation that you have coming from the sun. There's just the radiation that you get when you heat up a material, and then there's the discontinuous or the transitions that occur that give you the discrete radiation. So if you, okay, I'll give you an example.
So
let's
black by definition, whatever that is, the black body. When a black body is radiating, it's radiating a spectrum that's fairly continuous.
Yeah, and it's a predictable spectrum. Right. Matter of fact, if you if you have an electric stove and you look at the element as you heat it up, you get up to around 500 Celsius or so, and you start to see that it starts to glow red. Right. If you were to measure the spectrum, you would see it's not just a line. It's a black body type spectrum that's coming out of that, and it's just that the wavelength that's being emitted is starting to creep into the visible, just part of it. It's emitting a lot longer wavelengths too that you can't see, infrared radiation.
Right.
But as you heat it up, that spectrum shifts more and more toward the blue, and as that little tail starts to creep in into the visible, you start to be able to see the dull red glow. If you keep going, it turns yellow and then white. And then it explodes, but the sun is like the sun's about a 6,000 degree black body radiator, something like that, 6,000 Kelvin. I don't know. Did you want to give a more fundamental?
No, that's what you do.
So you do have the discrete lines too.
Because of the material that's there,
yeah.
Hydrogen helium, but if you by definition, like body, it's also at its height.
Yeah, what's a more fundamental way? I mean, that's what I'm struggling with while I was thinking about this, because what's a more fundamental way to explain the origin of black body radiation?
I think you could say, well, the temperature of an object is connected to the sort of the speed at which the things are vibrating. Heated up more, it's more and more. And the charged thing that vibrates around and moves, accelerates, emits radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the origin of black body radiation. But since things are moving, since the thermal motion is very random, you get a distribution of velocity, distribution of these frequencies and wavelengths that are emitted.
Yeah, accelerating charge radiates, so that makes sense. That's a good fundamental question, but it's two different sources.
Holy power.
Well, yeah, that's good. That's scary, but good.
You were scary before.
I can go back.
You guys probably need a break, but if you have anything else, let me know. Sure. It was fun. Mm-hmm.